From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. After a string of early successes and an Oscar for directing, Hollywood superstar Mel Gibson fell into despair in his mid-30s. He pulled himself out through the faith of his youth, a deeply traditionalist Catholicism that rejects even contemporary popes. Gibson came out of despair and into religion with a vision that he would make what he calls an historically accurate representation of the final hours and crucifixion of Jesus of Nazareth. The studios weren't so interested in a film about Christ that Gibson insisted on making in Latin and Aramaic, but Mel soldiered on to produce The Passion with $25 million of his own money and no clear prospects for a distributor. He said that the screenplay was written, quote, by the Gospels and directed by the Holy Ghost. More earthly concerns were raised months in advance of any release. A group of clergy and scholars claim that scripture as script is not only historically inaccurate, but at odds with Roman Catholic doctrine. At best, they worry that the film could damage Christian-Jewish relations. At worst, some charge it could revive the violent anti-Semitism that swirled around passion plays of medieval Europe. The plot thickens with charges of a stolen script, extortion, and threats from superstar Mel. The controversy shines a spotlight on conflicting interpretations of the Gospels and on a split between Roman and traditionalist Catholics. Tonight on Point, the saga of Mel Gibson's The Passion. Joining me now from Ossining, New York, is Peter Boyer, staff writer for The New Yorker. His article, The Jesus War, appears in the September 15th issue of the magazine. Good evening and welcome, Peter Boyer.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
Great. It's great to have you with us. And with me in the studio is Paula Fredrickson, professor of ancient Christian history at Boston University and author of Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. Paula Fredrickson, thanks so much for joining us.
Hello to you both.
So here we are, months before this film even comes out. One way or another, people, I guess, are assuming that it will sometime around Easter. And already a huge controversy around it. People are going to be hearing a lot about Mel Gibson's The Passion over the next months. We wanted to sit down tonight and talk about the background of this film, where it's come from, what's behind it, and what it illuminates in all kinds of ways in contemporary American culture, contemporary religious issues. Peter Boyer, you've written a kind of exhaustive story of the saga of the origins of this movie, but take us back. What's the real inception point? Where does the passion come from?
I think, Tom, I was actually surprised to hear that it came from a moment of crisis in Mel Gibson's own life. It is not ordinarily my area of interest, the angst suffered by Hollywood folk, but I was interested in this film, and I was able, through a series of happy circumstances, to go spend time with this filmmaker as he was making what promised to be a very interesting, at the least, film. And in the course of talking about some of the choices he was making and some of the controversies that he was trying to overcome, or at least work through, I asked him that question. And it turns out that he, in fact, had sunk into a very deep personal despair some years ago, and really wondered whether he could or even wanted to come out of it. You know, he said that he tried a lot of different things and went to a lot of different places and finally hit his knees and returned to Jesus Christ and the faith of his youth, which, as you said in your intro, is a very traditional form of Catholicism. And it was from that, he emerged from that, believing that he had to someday do something like this, and here it is.
And that is to tell the story of the final hours of Jesus, including the crucifixion, what's traditionally called the Passion. And this is a piece of drama, Paula Fredrickson, that's been performed for centuries.
That's true. It's something that's one of the major sorts of medieval dramatic productions. And enter this kind of highly dramatic presentation of a story that originates in the Gospels, foregrounds good guys versus bad guys. And traditionally in Western European culture, the role of the bad guys has been played by the Jews. And these passion plays echo in the former liturgy of the pre-modern Catholic Church, and this is a lot of what the changes of Vatican II addressed.
And, of course, Mel Gibson, or at least his father, I don't know where exactly Mel stands, maybe you can tell us, Peter Boyer, but Mel's father, famously through a New York Times article of some months ago, which has its own interesting history here, rejects Vatican II and all that came from that, the walking away from Latin, and included in Vatican II, and Paula, get me exactly the right language here, but Vatican II said this idea of Jews sharing collective guilt for the crucifixion of Jesus is wrong.
It stated it forthrightly, and it also gave teaching instruction on how to address issues of biblical interpretation and dramatic representations of the Passion in light of this change.
But here's where things get interesting. Peter Boyer, Mel Gibson doesn't buy Vatican II. So when Mel said that this is going to be written straight out of the Bible, he wasn't looking for anybody's mediation or any softening of the Gospels. In fact, what he's trying to do here is literally portray this on screen as told in the Gospels. Isn't that right?
Well put, yes. He was not looking for help in how to read the Gospels. And I think it's fair to say that Mel Gibson would contest the suggestion that Vatican II and Nostra Aetate notwithstanding, He would contest the suggestion that a straight or even literal reading of the Gospels is implicitly anti-Semitic. I don't think he would contest the idea that through the ages the Church has fostered an anti-Semitism and countenanced it, and that certainly there have been that one particular passage from Matthew, for example, where the crowd says, "His blood be upon us," speaking of Jesus, and upon our children. That plainly has a direct tie to the idea of collective guilt. However, again, as I say, in fairness to Gibson's position, I don't think that his personal faith of this traditionalist Catholicism, the fact that it rejects Vatican II for a number of reasons, not just the Nostra Aetate, means that, therefore I can go make an anti-Semitic movie. In other words, I think Mel Gibson, had he been an agnostic, an atheist, a complete post-Vatican II Roman Catholic, would have made just this movie. Something Paula said a moment ago, I think, cuts to the heart of it. She said that, you know, part of the problem with a literalist reading, in essence, sorry for paraphrasing, but is that it sort of sets up good guys versus bad guys, and the bad guys are the Jews. It's a fine point, but I think Mel Gibson would exactly agree with that. And I think the way he would put it is, I even hate to put words in his mouth, the way I saw in his film that he has put it, let's put it that way, is that, yes, there were bad guys, and the bad guys were those high priests, those Jewish authorities who turned Jesus of Nazareth over to the Romans for execution. The bad guys were Pontius Pilate for condemning him, and his Roman soldiers for tormenting him in the agony of the Passion and finally executing him. He sees his worldview as an artist is war, in case you haven't noticed.
Yes, we have. Braveheart right on through.
And in a way, and I think I even said so in the piece in the New Yorker, I mean, one sort of shorthand way of seeing this movie is, the crucifixion of Christ is brought to you by the guy who made Braveheart.
But Mel Gibson, I mean, there's so many things illuminated, even as you describe Mel Gibson's view there. It's just chock full of landmines and controversy, starting with this, what we've had in recent decades, this whole attention paid to the idea of the historical Jesus. And there, this debate over where responsibility lay for the crucifixion, some saying no one can know, some putting it exclusively on the Romans, saying he was crucified in order to make a public example. Only the Romans had the power to do that. Others saying Jewish officials at the time had some role. But Paula, it's pushing all of this right out into public. And you were saying a few minutes ago, before we sat down, that you've been astonished at the depth of feeling even today. Things that you as a scholar thought were kind of settled are still live issues.
Very much so. And through the miracle of email, I've been discovering that, because I get a lot of either distressed or furious emails from my fellow Americans talking about, well, what do you mean it's not, the Gospels aren't a straightforward historical transcript? I'd like to go back to Peter, to a point you just made, because in the publicly available trailer, it's not just the high priestly authorities who are the bad guys. Gibson chose to interpret the Gospel crowd as thousands of Jews packed in a courtyard, and when the actor playing Jesus is absolutely torn to shreds and Pilate presents him, that crowd also roars for Jesus' death. And I think that's, again, part of the problem of the simplicity of the good guy, bad guy representation.
I do think that it is the case that that this particular crowd is, enthusiastic about the events as they transpire. I don't think that it is what you might have in your mind's eye as the trailer, oddly enough, even though I've seen the film now in various versions three or four times, the trailer I have not seen, but I can tell you in the film, there's no mistake in this crowd for a crowd of thousands. I think it is implicit that this is as Paula says, that this is a Jewish crowd. It is not either implied or explicitly stated, I think, that which group of Jews they are. In other words, whether it is the court to the high priests in attendance who would, of course,
their bosses.
Yes, that's right. Or whether it is, in fact, Gibson has gone back on the road to the cross, those crowd scenes, and has pulled out, through subtitle and editing, has pulled out bits and pieces to suggest a much greater ambiguity among those people who are also mostly Jewish, some other folks.
But in their sentiment as Jesus carries the cross along the way. But what's pulled out here is so fascinating that scholars have been going along now for decades, building this case about the historical Jesus, which was, maybe in the ivory tower and somewhat beyond, building the idea that the Gospels are the Gospels, but fact is different. And now you have Mel Gibson in one of the most mass-market kind of, the most mass-market media in film, dragging it back the other way and saying, no, we're going to be literal. And Mel has told you, Peter, that, hey, these scholars don't know better than Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John what went on. And now, on the one hand, he's got the Anti-Defamation League saying they're afraid this could fuel hatred, bigotry, anti-Semitism. On the other hand, he's got real support from fundamentalist Christians who say, wow, this is a fantastic depiction. Never mind all this stuff about historical this and that. We've got the Gospels here, and they agree with Mel. The Gospels are what happened.
Yes, they do. And it's not just fundamentalist Christians. It is, and I'd like to hear whether Paula disagrees with my reading of this. I saw the film with a group of Jesuits, 350 or so Jesuits, who are not, as you know, fundamentalist Christians. I also saw it with a smaller group of evangelical Christians, both groups of which enthusiastically received the film. I saw Mel Gibson present a trailer of the film, just a trailer, but not the trailer you all are talking about. This was a thing of basically sort of Mel Gibson's greatest hits as by means of introduction to a convention, the Full Gospel Businessmen's Convention. And they gave him standing ovations and wanted to touch him and pray for him and all of that stuff. And it occurred to me that on some level, what they were cheering and what they were applauding, certainly that latter group hadn't even seen the movie, so it couldn't have been that. But was the idea, I got the feeling that there was being loosed some sort of pent-up stress over all the feelings about the popular culture and the academy's attitudes toward the matter of faith.
Well, stress that here fundamentalists are standing up and saying, finally, we've got Mel with the big megaphone saying the Gospels are what it's all about, never mind the kind of research you've done, Paula Fredrickson.
Well, I have to say, and here I am in public speaking in defense of Mel Gibson, it's impossible to do a literalist reading of the Gospels. Anybody with the best will in the world, what the Gospels really present, the analogy is more like sheet music. And depending on who the musician is, who the conductor is, that's the result you get. You have to interpret.
Paula Fredrickson, Peter Boyer, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about the saga of Mel Gibson's coming film of the final hours and crucifixion of Jesus, The Passion. We're going to go into the break listening to the theatrical trailer for The Passion. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Ecce homo!
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the saga of Mel Gibson's coming film of the final hours and crucifixion of Jesus of Nazareth, The Passion. It will likely be out around Easter next year, but it's already whipping up an enormous controversy. The story behind the origins and the production and the controversy over that film is our subject tonight, and it's awfully interesting. I'm joined tonight by Peter J. Boyer, staff writer for The New Yorker. He wrote The Jesus War, Mel Gibson's Obsession, in the September 15th issue of The New Yorker, joining us from Austining, New York. With me in the studio, Paula Fredrickson, professor of ancient Christian history at Boston University, author of Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. And joining us right now from Seattle, Washington, Michael Medved, film critic and nationally syndicated radio talk show host. Good evening and welcome, Michael Medved.
Thank you very much. I'm pleased to join the conversation.
It's great to have you to join in. We want to get your perspective in just a second, but if we could, Peter Boyer, if you'd be good enough, before we go on, I wish you would kind of paint a word picture. You've seen the film now, I guess versions of the film, 2-3 times. Try and bring it into our mind's eye.
It is dark, eerie, profoundly violent. It begins, Paula had a great description of the task of using the Gospels as script. They do differ in detail, and so it is a matter of sort of choosing, and then, of course, adding other material. Cinematically, what Gibson does is begin with this very kind of disturbing, nightmarish almost vision of Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, sort of wrestling with his moment, which of course is at hand, mm-hmm. the purpose of his being sent to mankind and asking that the cup pass from him and so on. That moment sort of climaxes in a little bit of violence, actually, and it sort of is quite, how to put it, muscular from there on out. I mean, it is a rather violent taking of Jesus. The scene from, I can't remember which or how many of the Gospels right now off the top of my head, but the scene from the Bible where Peter takes his sword and lops off the ear of one of the guards and Jesus heals it, then lots of smiting of Jesus on his way to the trial. And then what you see from there on, I mean, they're the crowd scenes in front of Pilate that are more vividly realistic, certainly, than any biblical movie I've ever seen. I'm not a film critic. I'll let you, Michael sort of...
Well, if I can jump in...
Michael Medved, you've seen it as well, and you've said it is, by a very large margin of advantage, the most effective cinematic adaptation of a biblical story I have ever seen. It's dark, it's violent, it's bloody, but you're saying this is the story the Bible tells, and this is a compelling rendition of it.
It's an extraordinarily compelling rendition of it. And look, first of all, when you're comparing it to other biblical movies, most biblical movies are terrible. They're embarrassing.
Because
they're horrendous.
Early the film... story of Ruth. Come on.
Right.
Well, they're embarrassing.
David and Bathsheba. I mean, in Ten Commandments, one of the things
because
that he does
they're so sugary and they're so filled with fakey Hollywood light and booming voices.
And also because they're in English. Mm-hmm. I think one of the decisions that Mel made that was a brilliant aesthetic decision was to unveil this film to have all of the characters speaking in Aramaic and Latin.
And will there be subtitles?
Yes.
He didn't want them.
Yes, I think Peter has established, I've spoken to Mel also mm-hmm. about it, and initially he was thinking of not doing subtitles. I think he may have been teasing about that, because the version that I saw, and I think the only versions he's shown to people, have subtitles, and the subtitles
are... You almost can't imagine it without subtitles, not because of the difficulty of, you know, I mean, I'm not saying
many people know the story. I mean, the general outline.
However, it is, you know, it's just another layer of information that is, excuse the use of this term, Medved, but filmic. You know, I mean, you need it. It helps.
It's absolutely necessary. But one of the things about the use of Aramaic, which very few people, obviously, in the film audience are going to understand on their own.
And Aramaic was the language of the common people of Palestine at that time, is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, I think Paula Fredrickson will agree that all the evidence that we seem to have is that would have been the primary spoken language of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Is it right, Professor Rector?
That's absolutely true.
Yeah, so in any event, the point about using that language and using Latin, though I know that Professor Fredrickson has raised some issues about, well, he should have used Greek, that Roman troops would have been speaking Greek instead of Latin, the point is, it takes it away from our world. In the Ten Commandments, there's a scene where Ann Baxter says to Charlton Heston, "Oh, Moses, Moses, you adorable, delicious fool, Moses."
And I block that out.
Oh, boy.
Right.
Yeah, that kind of thing doesn't occur here. And
it's like Breakfast
you have
Tiffany's.
Some sense of how distant this world is from our own, which is one of the reasons that I feel so strongly that I think some of the concerns about the film inspiring anti-Semitic actions and attitudes are wildly overblown.
Well, we'll talk about that, but I just want to get this sense out here. I mean, there have been many concerns raised on that front. On the other side, you and others, Cal Thomas, as Peter Boyer quotes him, says, "I can say The Passion is the most beautiful, profound, accurate, disturbing, realistic, and bloody depiction of this well-known story that has ever been filmed." On the other hand, you know, you've got Abe Foxman, head of the
ADL,
who hasn't seen the movie, but speaking intelligently about it. Again, Peter quoting him, saying, "The film per se is not anti-Semitic. The problem," he added, "was that, as with any literal reading of the New Testament, its message of love could be twisted into something hateful. The film can fuel, trigger, stimulate, induce, rationalize, legitimize anti-Semitism." Michael Medved, how do you see it coming out?
Well, first of all, that's obviously true, but that's true for any film about the crucifixion of Jesus. It could be twisted, it could be abused, it could be used by anti-Semites. And the Gospels have been used, and Passion plays have been used by anti-Semites countless times in history. The point is, that is not the intention, that is not the focus of this film. And frankly, anybody who is likely filled with such visceral hatred of Jews that he or she is about to commit some kind of anti-Semitic act or nurtures those feelings doesn't need Mel Gibson to remind them of the anti-Semitic elements in the gospel story. They are there. They are there, and they're present certainly in the film. But I think that people have been led to believe that somehow this movie focuses on Jewish people in the way that some old Passion plays did. One of the differences, and I think it's very important that we note that, is, for instance, if you look at D.W. Griffith's treatment of the same thing. In his acclaimed movie, Intolerance, he showed the Jews, the Judean authorities, as people wearing side locks and prayer shawls and skull caps and hooked noses, looking like the Jews who lived in certain neighborhoods in American cities. The Jewish authorities, the Judean authorities in this film, who are indeed the villains, look nothing at all like people in our world. I think that the distance that Mel is very careful to draw here between the Passion's world and the world of 2003 is one of the things that will help to tamp down any potential anti-Semitic impact.
I want to get Paula Fredrickson, your response to that. I mean, we're all at different levels of advantage and disadvantage here. Many people have not seen the film. Michael has, Peter has. There was this whole dust up over the fact that an early draft or some draft of the script came in by kind of an astonishing story, an unmarked envelope dropped off at a rabbi's house in Chicago, if I'm right.
I know that from Peter,
so so it ended up in the hands of a group of scholars, an interfaith group focused on ecumenical study of scripture. A group that in 1988 actually laid out guidelines for how when
that was the bishops' conference that laid out the guidelines.
All right.
The scholars are academics.
Two different groups, but only to say that there has been historically enough concern about this that there were specific guidelines laid down for how when the Passion Play was performed, how it ought to be performed to minimize the anti-Semitic interpretation that might be taken
there. And the way you just phrased that is important. Michael, that's something I'd like to nuance what you just said, please, because it's not that there are anti-Semitic elements in the Gospels, and it's precisely an historical reading of the Gospels that leads you to appreciate how much these are intra-Jewish documents. They're intra-Jewish controversies, and if you put the Gospels against the wallpaper of something like the Dead Sea Scrolls, it's just a lot of the controversy stories turn out to be Jews yelling at each other about the right way to be Jewish, which is, as you know, business as usual. It's the 19th centuries of anti-Jewish interpretation that stands between the modern reader of the Gospels and these stories that is the introduction of problems. And the issues with the anachronisms in Gibson's film, which he nonetheless persists in saying is historically accurate, and it's not, the anachronisms there all tend in the direction that coheres with that 19 centuries long anti-Semitic tradition. And that, as an historian, is what I was concerned about.
So you're saying whatever Mel Gibson intended, You're afraid this may be interpreted in the same way the Passion Play was interpreted for many centuries and often resulted in anti-Semitic.
Well, I think and enhancing what makes this a powerful movie is also what makes it, in a sense, more radioactive around this issue. I mean, there are pools of blood. There's a lot of physical violence. And a lot of the physical violence, an anachronism, he has Jewish temple soldiers arresting Jesus, which is in none of the Gospels. So that's where I think all these things come together. There are no car chases.
One of the problems that I have with all of these discussions is uses of terms like Jews and Jewish. Because one of the things that I think comes across very clearly in the actual film is that today, if you're in Boston or you're in Seattle, Jewish means a recognizable, identifiable religio-ethnic group. What you're dealing with here is ancient Judea, in which there are the natives and who are Judeans, and there are Romans. And I think it is worth pointing out that one of the things that Mel has done is he has gone to some lengths to try to make this the most Jewish Jesus who perhaps has ever been shown in film. There is a flashback showing the Last Supper and showing it very clearly as a Passover Seder.
Describe the actor who plays Jesus here.
Jim Caviezel, who from Mount Vernon, Washington, by the way, who, like Mel, is a very devout Catholic. And
was in The Count of Monte Cristo.
In The Count of Monte Cristo. He was in Angel Eyes. He got a lot of critical acclaim for The Thin Red Line. He's an actor who specializes in playing haunted parts. Mel actually gave him a prosthetic nose to make him look more Middle Eastern, more Semitic, more Jewish, if you will.
To one of the crowd of people that is there.
Correct. And his mother is played, Mary, is played by Maya Morgenstern, who is an actress from the Yiddish theater in Romania, who contributed what to me was one of the most surprising and rather inventive usages in the film, is on the night that he is arrested at the Garden of Gethsemane, the night before the crucifixion, and she is responding sort of in the middle of the night with Mary Magdalene, who's played by Monica Bellucci, to a disturbance of the force, if you will, and they understand that something is wrong, and she says, Manishtana halayla hazeh, why is this night different from all other nights, which is Aramaic, which would be appropriate, but it's a formulation from the four questions on the Passover Seder that everybody who's Jewish will recognize. So I would say that that moment is probably the clearest moment of identification with contemporary Jewish life. And it's a moment involving one of the, quote, good guys, the mother of the hero.
Michael Medved, I know we just have you for another minute, but Mel Gibson told Peter Boyer that the criticism of the film is itself an expression of vehement anti-Christian sentiment. What do you make of that?
I think that some of the criticism of the film has been terribly, terribly destructive. I'm Jewish. I was a synagogue president for 15 years and survived it. Mostly. And it's one of those things. Obviously, I am concerned, like Paula Fredrickson is, like we all are, about any kind of increase or encouragement of anti-Semitism. But I honestly believe that some of the attacks on Mel Gibson by people who have not even seen his movie are far more likely to provoke anti-Semitic reaction than anything in the movie itself. And one of the questions that I would ask, and I would put that on the table to Paula Fredrickson, to Peter Boyer, to Abraham Foxman, to Eugene Korn, to all of the people who have been in one way or another critical of the film, is what is it exactly that you want? I mean, Mel has already made changes in the movie, some of them that I have pushed for very, very hard, and I think that he's been very responsive to some constructive attempts to change his movie. For instance, there's a line in Matthew, the one you alluded to before, may his blood be upon us and our children. That's gone from the film. And thank God that it's gone from the film. It's a good thing that it was removed. But beyond that kind of constructive relationship, the public denunciations by the ADL, what are they supposed to accomplish setting up this adversarial position?
Let me ask that to Paula Fredrickson, who's right with us. And Paula Fredrickson, does it mean that what you don't or what you want is no more literal portrayals of the Gospels?
Oh, no, it's actually easier than that and cheaper for Gibson to do. I would just like him to stop claiming that this movie is historically accurate when it's not.
So it's just an academic concern on your part?
It's not just an academic concern, because an allusion to historicity in our culture is a way of saying this is true, this is what really happened. And it cannot be what really happened. I mean, he has every anachronism I can imagine in this movie except a car chase, thank God. I mean, it really is not a credible depiction of the first century. That's one thing. The misrepresentation.
When you say it's not historical.
Last Temptation of Christ, which has far more.
That was a movie about a novel.
Than this film does. And by the way, I think Last Temptation of Christ was far more anti-Semitic. It showed Jewish people sacrificing animals in their homes rather than in the temples, and was also soaked with blood. But you loved that movie.
You just asked me what I'd like to have changed. I'd like Gibson to stop saying that this is an historically accurate movie when it's not.
Let me ask just on that point, Paula Fredrickson, does this get us into the whole realm of the American debate over, let's say, evolution versus creationism? I mean, you're saying, as an academic, quite confidently, this is not history. But you know that there are millions of Americans who will say, this is truth.
I don't know if that's true, but
I think it's pretty evident, certainly in fundamentalist Christian realms, you know, people who take the Bible as literal and insist upon it as literal, and which seems to be what Mel's saying. He's saying, look, this is the Bible. These guys, they're telling their story. I understand all of, he's not saying this, but of course there's all the work that's been done on the history. But doesn't this just take us right back to that place in American culture where there's a disagreement over what constitutes truth?
If you mean by truth something like scientific truth, you mentioned evolution, I guess so. I mean, there are depictions. He had people running in and out of the temple at night, which, as Michael knows, is historically impossible. There's an accumulation of that kind of thing. And it's, you know, if he just said, I'm recovering from a personal conversion experience, I have a very powerful vision of the gospel, I'm going to take a teaspoonful of the Gospel of John, a cup of Matthew, a pound and a half of this 19th century nun, I'm going to put it into a blender, add Braveheart makeup, and poof, that's the Passion. Fine, he should live long and be healthy, but he didn't. It's this claim to authenticity and truth in an empirical way that I find misleading.
Peter Boyer, here's exactly the controversy that you've described the path of in your article, and it's still hot and probably going to get hotter before the film comes out.
Yes, it will. But I think, you know, this is a hunch. I have the feeling that when Paula Fredrickson sees this movie, she will, oddly enough, I think she will basically agree with Medved in terms of what she thinks of it. I mean, it is a powerful film. It is certainly the best version, the best film version of this story I've ever seen. In terms of the nature of the argument, it really does, it seems to me, come down to what you have just been trying to pull out there, which is there are folks who say it's in the Bible, it is so.
If I can intrude one last thing.
Just got 20 seconds here, Michael, please.
To Mel's claim that there is an anti-Christian bias going on along here. When the first attack on this film came out in March in the New York Times Magazine, there was a huge attack on the ideas of Mel's father, many of which are kind of crackpot ideas. But when you attack somebody's 84-year-old father, when you question his personal faith, that is not an appropriate way of criticizing a movie. I agree very much with Peter Boyer. I think when people actually see this movie, they will be surprised at how affecting, artistic, and successful it turns out to be.
Michael Medved, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much.
Michael Medved is film critic and nationally syndicated radio talk show host. We're talking tonight about the saga of Mel Gibson's coming film of The Final Hours and Crucifixion of Jesus, The Passion. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the saga of Mel Gibson's coming film about the final hours and crucifixion of Jesus of Nazareth. It is called The Passion, and it is stirring up quite a storm. My guests tonight, Peter J. Boyer, staff writer for The New Yorker, wrote The Jesus War, Mel Gibson's Obsession. With me in the studio, Paula Fredrickson, professor of ancient Christian history at Boston University. And with me on the phone right now from Santa Monica, California, Barbara Nicolosi. She's director of Act One. It's an interdenominational screenwriting program that stresses artistry and ethics. Welcome, Barbara Nicolosi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Barbara, have you seen the film?
Yes, I have. I actually watched it with a group of about 6 or 7 people there, and Mel was there.
You're a Hollywood person. You're an ethicist, self-described. What did you think of the film?
As a work of art, it's stunning. From a script perspective, there's some few story problems, but as a work of art, the movie is stunning. I've been listening to your discussion, and I just have to say a word for artists here. I'm very leery of anything that sounds like we're going to try to tell artists what they can or cannot do or say. You know, you always get into trouble when you ask an artist to try to theologize about their product. The artist makes something based on an inspiration from inside of them, and then the problem comes in when you try to ask them to then be a theologian. You know, the Pope has referred to art as something that is a genuine source of theology, but that's not to say that artists are theologians. And some of the problem is in when Mel is representing himself describing the film, they're trying to force him to be a theologian, and that's not what he is.
You're in California. What's the Hollywood reaction been?
I would say that the community is very excited to see this film because they know he's a great director, and Mel can deliver. Let's face it, people have worked with Mel for years. They know he's not anti-Semitic, so I think a lot of people feel really badly about the way this discussion has gone. A lot of people are really confused because they do not understand the polarization in the Catholic Church issues that keep coming to the head. You know, is he on the right? Is he on the left? Is he in the middle? You know, what's the difference between a traditionalist and an Orthodox?
Right.
I think most of the people in Hollywood are completely clueless about that. If you want to know what the real controversy in Hollywood is, it's, I would say, much less about the Jewish question and much more about, and he did it without English?
Right. And he did it with his own money, and who's going to distribute it? Barbara Nicolosi, thanks for joining us tonight.
Sure.
Peter Boyer, I want to go back and just bring one loop in this story forward again for a minute. You write about how Mel Gibson, after he had, as you say, fallen to his knees and sort of re-embraced Christianity, Catholicism, and this very traditional version of it, he found it was kind of a hassle to go to the nearest Catholic church. He decided to build one on property that he owned near his home in Malibu, and that the son of a neighbor who was opposed to building this church actually wrote this New York Times article in March that raised so much of a controversy around the religious views of his father, Hutton Gibson. Is that right?
Yes, Hutton Gibson is Mel's daddy, and he is a traditionalist Catholic, and he was quoted in that same New York Times magazine story as having uttered some goofy thing.
He said Vatican II was a Masonic plot backed by the Jews.
Yes, among other things. Mm-hmm. And what that article had the effect of doing was the logic went like this. Mel Gibson's father follows a medievalist strain of Catholicism. Mel Gibson also follows that strain. Mel Gibson's father is representative of that strain and holds these nutty ideas. Mel Gibson is making a movie. Will that movie about Jesus, therefore, in essence, follow the line of this strain of Catholicism? That, in any way, seemed to be the red flag that popped up. And all sorts of folks who have a quite legitimate interest in the academic treatment of biblical material or in the interfaith aspect of it or what have you, saw that signal as, holy smoke, we better get involved here. And it strikes me that that was the trigger of this controversy.
Mel, on the one hand, he said the controversy has been the most amazing marketing he's ever seen. On the other hand, as you quote him, he's not necessarily his most diplomatic best spokesman. He responded to a column by Frank Rich in the Times saying, I want to kill him. I want his intestines on a stick. I want to kill his dog. I mean, it sounds straight out of Braveheart there.
Yes. I ended my lead by saying he's not making a Jesus movie, he's making a war picture. And in some way, that is his whole orientation. I think it's partly his artistic orientation as well, but it certainly is in the context of this movie. He feels besieged and beleaguered and unfairly, you know, taken after and all of that stuff. I mean, he really is almost to the point of paranoia about the criticism here. In the particular instance that you cite, that Frank Rich column, the thing that got him so piqued was Frank Rich had asked to see the film. Mel Gibson's flack, a guy named Alan Nerob, said, no, you can't see it. We're not going to show it to the New York Times after what the Times did, basically. Rich then writes a column calling this publicist a Holocaust denier defender, in reference apparently to Mel Gibson's father.
Who has questioned the numbers of Holocaust dead,
yes.
I guess.
Yes. So Gibson happens to know, of course, his publicist. He knows him personally. He's his friend. He works for him. They work together. And he knows that this guy, Alan Nerob, who's just been called in a column in the New York Times a Holocaust denier defender, is the son, in fact, of Holocaust survivors. He was, in fact, at Simon Wiesenthal's side at the opening of the Holocaust Museum. And Gibson, being hot and a hothead, yep, you know, utters that string of oaths.
Paula Fredrickson, I wonder that a film like this, are you concerned that it's going to set back the years and years of work that you've done looking at the historical Jesus in the popular mind, anyway.
I think that one of the great strengths of Christianity is the doctrine of the Incarnation, which says that Jesus didn't just sort of pop into history at any particular moment, but at a particular moment in time, that he was a real person in real time. And for that reason itself, I think a concern about the historical Jesus is intrinsic, in a sense, to Christianity. This film is a great opportunity for public education. And for that reason, despite my anxieties about how it might affect how people treat each other, it might exactly be a good thing.
But the education that Mel Gibson wants to deliver, Peter Boyer, doesn't sound like it lines up with the Paula Fredrickson historical Jesus research view of the world.
Well, I have the feeling that in its heart, it does so more than might be apparent just now. I think that Paula will find less to disagree with when she sees it. I told him, y'all ought to bring her in and let her see the thing. In a way, it's unfair to her to have to judge it on the basis of what she hears about it.
It's been a fascinating hour. I hope it helps people understand the whole debate around this film as it moves toward release. Peter Boyer, it's been great having you. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
It was great to be with you. Thank you, Tom. So long, Paula.
Bye-bye.
Peter Boyer is a staff writer for The New Yorker, and Paula Fredrickson, thank you very much for being with us
My pleasure.
Paula Fredrickson is professor of ancient Christian history at Boston University. She was one of the nine-person ad hoc group of Catholic and Jewish scholars who reviewed a draft of the Passion script. She's written Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Antonín Dvořák is perhaps the most famous classical composer of Czech descent. Many of his best-known pieces were written after a visit to the United States in the late 19th century, when he began to weave African and Native American musical themes into his symphonies. Audio archaeologist Ned Connors digs up sounds and stories from the past for On Point. This week, we've been bringing you some of Ned's best pieces from 2003. Tonight, he brings us the story of an African-American musician from Erie, Pennsylvania, and the indelible mark he left on Dvorak during the great Czech composer's stay in the United States.
The celebrated Czech composer Antonín Dvorak arrived in New York City in 1892 to direct the National Conservatory of Music. An innovative school, unusual in that it welcomed deserving female, African, and Native American students. Dvorak, who grew up in Bohemia, had had no previous contact with blacks. In a famous and controversial letter to the New York Herald in September of 1893, he said this of the plantation songs introduced to him by his black students at the conservatory. Negro melodies are the real foundation of any serious and original school of composition to be developed in the United States. In these melodies, I discover all that is needed for a great and noble school of music. His Symphony from the New World, grafting purely American influences onto a European classical form, premiered the same year to great acclaim and considerable debate. One of Dvorak's African-American students, Harry Burley, played a profound role in introducing spirituals to the Bohemian composer. Born in 1866, Burley listened to and learned the sorrow songs sung by his maternal grandfather, a former slave. His mother, despite a college education and fluency in French and Greek, worked as a domestic in the household of Mrs. Elizabeth Russell, who held recitals in her home. Young Harry was allowed to answer the door and listen to the performances. Burley had some musical training in Erie. At age 26, with $30 in his pocket and a letter of recommendation from Mrs. Russell, he auditioned for a seat at the conservatory and received a scholarship to begin his studies the same year that Dvorak arrived at the school. A gifted baritone and pianist, Burley became Dvorak's personal assistant and friend. And during those years in New York, he introduced the spiritual to his Bohemian mentor.
I got a harp, you got a harp, and all the brass you got a harp. Way to get it, him, gonna play on the harp, gonna play all the him, him, him. Hey, the band's talking about him, he's going to him, him, gonna play all the him.
I got
As Burley described them, spirituals weren't composed, but sprang into life, ready-made from the white heat of religious fervor, the simple, ecstatic utterance of wholly untutored minds. In this 1916 recording of Heaven, Heaven, the Tuskegee Institute singers evoked the primitive, centuries-old vocal traditions of West Africa. Dvorak was captivated by the melodies and harmonies of the spirituals he learned from Burley, and he encouraged him to transcribe and arrange them for publication. It took a while, but in 1917, Burley published a collection of 48 Negro spirituals arranged in the tradition of the European art song for solo voice and piano. Here's a young Marian Anderson performing Burley's arrangement of Deep River in 1924. Reversal of musical tradition, William Arms Fisher, another student at the National Conservatory, composed what some called a pseudo-spiritual based on the Largo from Dvorak's New World Symphony. He called it Going Home. Here's Paul Robeson live at Carnegie Hall in 1958. Dvorak's belief that African influences would have a profound, defining effect on the future of American music was remarkably prescient. But it didn't happen in classical music as he imagined. In 1917, the same year that Burley published his art song arrangements of Negro spirituals, the Victor Studios in Camden, New Jersey, recorded a little-known New Orleans band then playing an engagement at a Manhattan restaurant, the original Dixieland Jazz Band. African-American influences would come to define American music, but this influence would come from the wellsprings of jazz, blues, and rock and roll. They all have their roots in the plantation songs of sorrow and hope, so beloved of Dvorak and Burley.
I'm going home, the Lord. I'm going home. I'm going home, the Lord. I'm going home.
Ned Connors is On Point's audio archaeologist. He lives in Barrington, Rhode Island. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Brother, come home, the Lord. Brother, come home. Brother, come home, Lord, Lord. Brother, come home.
I'm going home.